it was sort of the middle of the night, and I think I'd Googled, you know, feeling guilty, dead alcoholic parent, something like that. And I popped this website for NACOA, and I'd never heard of them before. It turns out there's this whole charity that is specifically for people who've been affected by parental drinking. And it was just one of those kind of pin drop moments. It's like, oh my God, we've got a name. We're called COAs. We're Children of Alcoholics. And there's this page on the website where people have written their personal stories about maybe some of their experiences or how they felt. And actually, they're saying all the things I felt that I've never heard anybody else say.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scofield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today, we have a really fantastic guest whose star shines so brightly for those in times of real darkness. Amy Dixon is a trustee of NACOA, National Association of Children of Alcoholics, and has been involved in the charity since 2020, shortly after her father had died as a result of alcohol addiction. Amy is passionate about using her lived experience and her interest in education and social mobility to ensure children of alcoholics have support that she didn't have. Today we talk about Amy's story and the resources in place if you are concerned about a child of a parent who might be struggling with addiction. Amy, thank you so much for coming on. This is powerful.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate you being here. I'd love to start in the beginning, like where are you from and how was your early childhood?
I've always grown up in the southeast. From my perspective, very, very traditional upbringing. You know, kind of mum, dad, brother, nice car. My dad worked in London. We had a nice house. Everything very, very normal. I don't remember a time where my dad wasn't drinking alcohol and where people weren't probably mentioning it or it wasn't causing issues.
Even as a really, really young child?
Even as quite a young child, yeah. So I think my earliest memories are probably, I don't know, from about seven onwards with it. I was always aware that alcohol was present. And sometimes I would worry about my dad. I would worry from a really young age about where he was, when he was getting home, how he was getting home. And I felt quite responsible for him. I used to wake up in the night with these awful nightmares and be terrified that there was a bear in the house. And I used to freeze in my bed and I used to think, what will I do when the bear comes up the stairs? And it was about kind of, could I get to my brother and shut his door? And then could I go and tell my parents? Or should I just lay there and should I let the bear eat me and then everybody else will be okay? And it turns out, obviously, there wasn't a bear in my house. It was my dad snoring because he was drunk. And it's taken, you know, like that kind of penny drop moment, probably only a few years ago. I was like, oh my God, that's what that noise was.
That's
now
incredible.
It all makes sense.
Wow.
And then I would say probably from maybe 9, 10, 11, he started drinking quite heavily. If we went, you know, my parents were terribly sociable, my dad was always the one who drank the most. He was always the one passed out at the end of the party. He was also super good fun. You know, he was really good fun. I absolutely worshipped my dad. I thought he was brilliant. And he was never nasty with it. And then actually he did, I think when then people started to question his relationship with alcohol, then he did start to get verbally. Yeah. Quite defensive. So there was this story, again, I don't particularly remember it. My parents had people around for dinner and somebody had said something to my dad about his drinking and he'd picked up a bottle of red wine and he'd thrown it at a wall.
So he knew then, I guess, himself. And
yeah, and there was always a reason for it, right? He had a really good job in London. He worked in the construction industry. He had to do a lot of client entertaining. It was part of his job. That was who he was. He liked drinking. He didn't have a problem with it. He actually was very negative about people with alcohol addiction.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, in later years when it was very apparent that's what he was, he would be absolutely scathing about addicts or people with mental health problems. And he just didn't align himself with that at all. And there was always a reason. He couldn't be an alcoholic because he drank expensive red wine. He wasn't drinking cheap spirits from the supermarket. Mm. He wasn't an alcoholic because he was going out to really lovely restaurants, not sitting on his own in a pub. And of course, the irony is by the time he died, he was drinking cheap spirits from the supermarket and he was spending an awful lot of time on his own in a pub.
Yeah.
He just was at the start of a journey, not at the end of it.
And it's sad, isn't it? Because it's like a corroding kind of, it's like a virus almost. Just
yeah, of
slowly
course.
Gets
and
worse
it's so,
and worse.
It's progressive, right? Yeah. So I think what happens when you're at the start of that illness is you look at the people at the end and they're so far removed from what you are then.
Yeah.
You can't see, you can't believe that you will become that person. And yeah, by the time my dad died in 2020, if you looked back to 5, 10, 15 years previously, my brother and I couldn't believe where we'd ended up.
Mm.
We were living, you know, this kind of nightmare situation that whilst I look at it now and go, well, of course that's how it was going to end, you just couldn't believe where you'd ended up from where you started.
Yeah.
And actually, again, it's taken an awful lot of work, but I couldn't believe that somebody would let themselves end up where he ended up from what he had. It just made no sense. And I very much saw it at the time that he had chosen.
Oh, really?
To do that, yeah. I am more sympathetic 5 years after his death and to other people struggling with addiction than I was when he was alive.
It would make you really angry, I guess, because it makes no sense for a loved one to destroy themselves and the people around them, right?
There's so much to be angry about when you're dealing with a loved one who's doing it. And it's very, very hard to be sympathetic to them because, again, now I can look at it and say, well, of course he didn't choose that. And I always knew that you wouldn't choose it. But when somebody gets up every day and cracks open a bottle and chooses to consume, I didn't understand, I think, about the illness of it. I didn't understand the mental and the physical dependency that he had. To me, it was very much, but you're choosing not to engage with help. You're choosing not to make yourself better. You're choosing to wake up every day. And he was living in chaos, absolute chaos by the end. And I did just used to think, well, just don't do it today. But actually, I was so exhausted for the last few years. We just didn't, I mean, it sounds mad, but we did not talk about the fact that he was in the final stages of an alcohol addiction.
Sometimes things are too painful to talk about. And you can kind of just hope. It's like being on a car with no brakes, just hope we're not going to crash, but you stay in the car. You're just like, please don't crash, please don't crash. Was it kind of like that?
Yeah, I think so. In that I never believed confronting it would yield me the response or the outcome that I wanted. Yeah. I think lots of people over a number of years had tried to speak to him and tried to help him and nothing had happened. I knew that alcohol would come before everything else. So I'd spent a lot of time feeling second best to this substance. I knew that if I asked him outright, he would be incredibly defensive and then he'd sort of go AWOL. And I really needed to keep tabs on him and make sure he was as safe as he could be. And also, I was just exhausted by it and I knew that there was very little point. And also, I didn't trust it. And actually, there's something to be said for the fact there was a predictability in his drinking. And now I look at it and go, well, if he had entered sobriety, in a way, that would have been scarier. Because I would have then been even more on eggshells and even more anxious that he was going to, you know, stop that sobriety and then we'd be back to square one. I'd been so scared of him falling off the wagon and going back to it.
Yeah, makes sense.
I'd have been more anxious to have a dad who was sober.
Really? That's a very valid point.
I mean, I'd have loved it, don't get me wrong, But I think it's the cruelest, one of the cruelest illnesses for the people who are witnessing it.
Yeah.
Because you don't ever lose that little glimmer of hope. And that's the cruelest thing about it.
Yeah.
Because again, even when everybody on the outside can see, you know, I always knew my dad would die because of his addiction to alcohol. I waited 20 plus years for a phone call to tell me he was dead, which is a really long time to wait for the phone to ring.
Yeah, it's
and I didn't know what it would look like, but I always knew it was coming. And it's actually 5 years ago today that I did get that phone call. But underlying that was always just that little tiny flicker of hope that it wouldn't.
And that's painful.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. That's
and
really
you
painful.
Kind of, you know, was I enough? What could I have done differently? How could I have treated him differently? You know, if I'd been nicer instead of really angry with him. You know, all of those things, you question so much around your behavior. And ultimately, the truth is that you can't stop somebody, regardless of how much you love them. You cannot stop them from drinking or being addicted to another substance, because actually it's not about you. And that's also really cruel. That's a really cruel realization. And it's a sad thing to tell people. This is nothing to do with you. And it's not that you're not enough. It's that actually you're a completely separate entity to that addiction. But growing up with it, you would feel, you know, you do feel second best to a substance in a bottle.
Which is really difficult, because it makes no sense for a parent to put you not first, because that's instinctually what we do. I mean, that's what I do with my kids. But I know if I was in active addiction, they wouldn't come first. Something takes the person over. It's almost like being possessed, you know, and this obsessive mind about what you've got to do and looking after yourself. It's like this subconscious thing that just program that runs you.
And I think it's really difficult to understand, you know, and I, again, look back now and I'm like, when was, because it's not something I've experienced personally, an addiction, but it's that thing of, when did you wake up and decide the best way to feel better was to have a drink? Like, how did you feel the day that you realized you'd crossed that line? Mm. How did you feel the first day that maybe you had like a toileting accident? How did you feel the first day you woke up, you know, kind of covered in your own vomit? Like, that slippage is really difficult to understand. And again, from an outsider's perspective, you just go, for goodness sake, look at you. Why are you continuing this behavior? You know, the first time he wrapped his car around a lamppost, the first time he lost his driving license. If you look at that slippage, at no point did he, you know, you said about putting those brakes on. Mm. The brakes never came on.
Yeah. It's astonishing.
It's absolutely astonishing is one word.
Yeah. But that shows you the power of this disease that someone has when they have it.
My daughter's nearly 16. She's got her birthday next week. And I remember when I had her, that was really difficult phase for me, because I can remember sort of holding her just thinking, I would never do that. How can you look at this child? And of course, that's a really unfair example, because I wasn't in addiction. I hadn't experienced it. But I just remember, I was so angry with him for that period as well, on top of everything else. Then having my own children just added this other complexity to it.
I totally understand that. When you, going back to when you was nine and the incident with the bottle being smashed, did that accelerate any anxiety, or was that kind of like, oh, we've crossed the line now with behaviour?
I think it did. And I can now piece different bits together. So my parents ended up separating. And I think his drinking did play a significant factor in that.
Yeah.
And actually that, in a way, made it better and worse in equal measure. It made it better because home was then incredibly stable, safe place. It was me, my mum and my brother, and that was just the way it was. So I never had the concerns that I know lots of people growing up do. You know, I never had that thing of putting the key in the door and worrying what I would find. And I was very fortunate that I did always just have this home to go to. But the anxiety then massively increased because my dad was essentially rogue on his own living in London. And everybody was really angry with my dad when he left. And He did completely go off the rails, but I felt then it was my job to make sure he was safe, well, looked after, and make sure he was okay.
How old was you then?
Probably about 12, 13.
Oh, such a weight on the shoulders of a 12-year-old.
Then that's when I just sort of assumed at all times my dad was dead. That's when that started, because I wasn't physically seeing him every day and I wasn't hearing that car come home and I wasn't seeing him in the mornings. From there on in, my default position was, my dad has died overnight. The phone will ring in a minute to tell me.
How did that affect you in school life and friendships? Because that's a big weight to carry.
School was fine. I liked the predictability of it, but I didn't have somebody I could confide in. And I wouldn't have done either, because I'd have been really worried about the judgment on me, on him, any consequences, you know, that might have happened. And actually, he'd have been absolutely furious, moreover. You know, if he'd have had a phone call from a school saying, your daughter's worried about your drinking, that was not a conversation that would have ended well. You know, he was not open to...
Well, you're throwing him under the bus as well, aren't you, as a father in a way?
Which I wouldn't have done.
Yeah.
You know, my job, as I saw it, was to protect him at all costs. And if that meant keeping that secret and being in charge and being in control, then that was what I was going to do. But I would phone him. I would phone his office every day from school. So they had a payphone. And I would wait for school to start. And I would, you know, either say I needed to go to the loo and I would go down to the hall and I would put my 20p in. And I would phone his office and wait for him to answer the phone. And then I would hang up.
Oh, bless you. So he knew it was you, did he? Finally.
I don't know. And then, you know, like in later years, I didn't necessarily want to speak to him every day, but I'd check my phone and see when he'd been last on WhatsApp. And that was, you know, genuinely a way of seeing if my dad was alive.
Yeah. If he didn't answer the phone or you didn't have any connection, would you think that's it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would have spent all day in school just waiting for someone to come to the classroom to knock on the door.
God, such a thing.
And like the unpredictability of it as well, because he had started getting into sort of scrapes and accidents and falling off trains and, you know, again, smacking his head open on a curb. And we weren't shielded from any of that information. Like, we knew all these things had happened. So there was an unpredictability as to how my dad was going to die. Was it going to be, you know, and he'd lost his driving license and then he'd lost a job. And again, you can all see it coming. It's all a fairly well-trodden path. But the nature of how people can injure themselves when they're under the influence, my imagination would run wild. I mean, I would literally lay in bed planning what I would say at his funeral.
Looking back at that, can you see how much pressure that was for you? As a parent, like if you looked at your children, had to go through the same worry, it's so much to add on to normal life, which is quite difficult anyway, isn't it?
I can see it, but I don't think I'm out of that yet. I'm still very much, and maybe that is just something I have to accept is now such an integral part of my personality.
Yeah.
No, see, when you say that, I would say, oh no, it was fine. That's just what I did. And yes, of course, I wouldn't want my children to have to do that. And, you know, I work now through the work I do with lots of children and young people. And of course you would be saying to them, that's not your job. But I think I've internalized it so much that I genuinely would sit here and say, oh no, it's absolutely fine.
Totally get that. Because you're a survivor, aren't you?
Yeah.
Before you become a trustee and outreach coordinator for NACOA, which is brilliant, we'll talk about those guys. What did you do for your first job? How did you go into work? And when you become a teenager, did you start drinking?
Didn't really drink particularly till I would say probably sort of 18, 19. I would say it definitely now, again, looking back, it did have a huge impact on GCSEs were fine. A-levels weren't great. I tried to go to university twice and I just couldn't cope with being away from home.
Yeah.
At all. And then I felt really stupid and I felt like a real failure and I kind of came home. And so I'm sort of now, I'm still really waiting to know what I want to do when I'm a grown up. Because which is a
Me
worry.
Too.
Really, I should be retiring any day now. But it has had a massive impact. And the truth is you shouldn't have regrets and it's all, you know, part of life's rich tapestry. The regrets I have are around I didn't feel supported enough to get through university. I didn't have help, wasn't available to me. I didn't ask for any help. And actually, I think I haven't really ever had a confidence to know what I wanted to do, because I think I've sort of just lurched from one thing to another. And a lot of it has been about, are people going to be nice to me? Mm. And will I fit in that environment? You know, I'm a real people pleaser. So actually, I don't think I would have coped terribly well in, you know, sort of quite a high pressured. I think also I had a lot of external pressures that meant I wouldn't have coped in a work environment where I had that. You know, I remember a job in my 20s where my dad had tried to take his own life on the Saturday night, and I'd had to race down to where he was living, and there were ambulances and hospitals and, you know, speaking to his doctors and all of that. And I just went to work on the Monday.
These are the things I think people don't realise when you say someone's either a heavy drinker or an alcoholic, how it affects the family members of all the receiving information of accidents, worrying about are they coming home when they do something like what you just said.
It's another mental job. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, then, so that was one example. And then there was, you know, a situation where he was really, really poorly, and he ended up in hospital for several weeks because he'd had a deep vein thrombosis that he hadn't noticed because he was not mentally capable of noticing. And I had two small children, and he lived in Oxford and I lived in Surrey, and I was going backwards and forwards and dealing with all that. And actually, in latter years, essentially, it was like having a third child. And he'd phone in the middle of the night and just, you know, either be very angry or very sad, or he'd come up with a new harebrained scheme. And actually, the easiest way to do it was just to placate him the way you would a toddler.
Mm.
And I'd say, well, you know, that sounds great. I mean, at one point, he phoned me at 3 a.m. to tell me he was going to get his private pilot's license the following year.
I could cry on things like that, because you think, from standing back, you can see the pain that causes and the energy that's taken away from everything else. And I think that's probably what people don't understand, is the anxiety that's provoked, the fear of, you know, fight or flight, which you have to live on, is most of your energy banks. So it's hard to do other stuff whilst you've got this situation going on.
And I think I've sort of had to resolve that me being, you know, I don't think people would meet me and go, I bet she's really anxious. Like, I've worked very hard.
You look very smooth when
you're coming. Absolutely. But, you know, that's the same with lots of people who are struggling with different things. But actually, I've lived with this kind of fight or flight and this high state of anxiety probably for the best part of 40 years. So of course I can't turn up. I mean, one, you couldn't turn up in the 90s and say you were feeling anxious, because people would have given you a clip around the ear and told you to sort yourself out.
Take the closest door.
But also, I've just had to accept that that's who I am. You know, like, my children know that I really do like to be in charge of things, and I will apologize to them and say, I'm really sorry. You know, I'll often send my husband a WhatsApp going, really sorry. And, you know, all my friends know that I like to be the one in charge of things. Yeah. And actually, me being in control and in charge of things is actually a coping strategy for me. If I've got, you know, everything under control, that's one less thing for me to worry about.
Most people I talk to who have a parent that was an alcoholic need to be safe and are actually very good at controlling situations and organization.
Because you also turn out, you're always constantly on that thing of predicting and being on eggshells. So, you know, with my dad, and again, this is something I hear all the time, I would phone and I would know within two words whether he was drunk or sober or how much he drunk. So you're always listening out for those tiny little moments, a tone of voice, a look on a face. Is this going to explode, you know, into something unpleasant very quickly? So again, that's where that sort of people pleasing, calm exterior comes from, where inside you're going, oh my God, what did they mean when they said that? How did they just look at me? Is that going to kick off? You know, if I'm on a train on a Saturday night, I'm just waiting for disaster.
I was going to ask you about that, because when we was in the theatre, a few years back, and I'm sitting, I'm like, oh my God, this woman next to me, she's done probably three halves of these bottles and she's doing her bag, and I couldn't see or hear anything on the stage. I'm just feeling the chair move, looking for the nuances, waiting for her to do something. And sure enough, she started to get verbal. Oh, this is rubbish. Oh my God, what are they doing? Oh, right, right, right. And I started to get, I just wanted to leave at that point. And I was literally stiff in my chair. And finally she went to whoever guy she was with, bless him. Right, let's go, this is rubbish. And she tapped my leg as she went past. And I went to say something. She goes, are you talking about me? And I was like, no, I'm just talking to my friend. And I felt like a school child. It was really weird. But that's how much you get affected by stuff, right?
Yeah, like I didn't love going to clubs or really busy bars, even as a teenager. And I certainly wouldn't now. I mean, one, because, you know, if there's not a seat, I'm not going
back. A padded one.
Yeah. But I didn't like it. I don't like the unpredictable nature of other people. So, you know, if I'm going to a concert or anything, I have to really think about how I'm going to get there. I'll only go if I can have a seat. I would never go to a concert if it was standing because there's too many people around me and it could really kick off at any moment. And I'm just waiting for it to happen. We just went on holiday in the summer and we got my son tickets to see AC Roma in Italy. Anyway, I bought them on the website. Basically, we're in with the ultras.
Wow.
Oh, he loved it.
I bet.
I spent 90 minutes. I mean, you can just imagine, 90 minutes.
Hanging off the bar probably.
Honestly, like gripping my hands because I'm just looking for that nod from somebody to somebody at the back or waiting for something to come up. You know, just living in that real...
hyper-awareness.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. It's not even necessarily about keeping me safe. So if I was with my husband and my children, be how would I get them out? Mm. And actually, again, it's that kind of self-sacrificing thing of how do I keep everybody else safe and out of a situation that is potentially harmful?
Yeah. The work you do now, how did you get into NACOA?
As a kind of backstory, I got my phone call to say that my dad had died. And I was... so shocked, which is, again, ridiculous because I'd waited 20 years and I just couldn't, I could not believe that it finally happened. And I was so many things, so relieved, but I was also so much sadder than I thought I would be. And I was shocked and I was fairly ambivalent and I was weirdly all sorts of things all at once. And one of the very first things I said to my husband was, oh, I don't have to put my phone on. I don't have to put my phone on tonight anymore. Because the last thing I'd always done for years was to make sure my phone was by my bed with the ringer on because I knew that, you know, either he'd phone or I would get that phone call. And just this thing of, I felt quite free. So when I got the phone call, we were away for the weekend. We were in Devon. So we were driving back. And actually, the thing in those first couple of days, the thing that made me the saddest was that I hadn't been home. It involved the police and lots of other things. But the thing that upset me the most, and still is the thing that upsets me the most, is that my dad had been found and he lived in Oxfordshire and I lived in Surrey. And Surrey police had come to my house and they'd knocked on the door. And I wasn't home. And then Sussex police had gone and knocked on my brother's front door and they had told him and he'd had to phone me. And the thing that made me the saddest was that my baby brother, and just to be clear, he was 39 years old at this time and perfectly capable. But the thing that gutted me the most was that I hadn't been there to answer the door because I felt so sad that my little brother had had to open the door and take on that information because I had always been.
Which makes total sense.
Really protective of my brother. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
you've missed a call because you had the phone on all the time.
Yeah. And I hadn't been there when it had finally happened.
Oh, man.
So it was really complicated, really complicated. And then I'd sort of beat myself up a little bit and go, why are you so sad? Like, you've literally wanted this to happen. You've wanted this to be over for a really long time, and now it is. And anyway, I after a few days, I was like, I cannot be the only person who's lost a parent because of alcohol. I just can't be. And it was sort of the middle of the night, and I think I'd Googled, you know, feeling guilty, dead alcoholic parent, something like that. And I put this website for Nicoa, and I'd never heard of them before. It turns out there's this whole charity that is specifically for people who've been affected by parental drinking. And it was just one of those kind of pin drop moments. It's like, oh my God, we've got a name. We're called COAs. We're Children of Alcoholics. It's a thing. I've actually got this whole identity. And there's this website, and there's this page on the website where people have written their personal stories about maybe some of their experiences or how they felt. And actually, they're saying all the things I felt that I've never heard anybody else say. So kind of started off by doing a little bit of stalking of their website. I think I then did some fundraising for them, started to get a little bit more involved as a volunteer, did their volunteer training. In 2023, I was asked to join the board of trustees. And then in April last year, so 2024, we received some funding to fund a education outreach program, which is something I'd been doing as a volunteer. I'd been going into schools local to me and working with their safeguarding leads and their behaviour support departments and doing teacher training and pupil presentations. And actually what that funding allowed us to do was to sort of do it in a more structured way and to try and roll that out nationally. So a lot of the work is visiting schools, universities, colleges, anyone that will have us really, and highlighting the scale of the problem. Because I think what I didn't know and what most people don't know is that one in five children in the UK, and that's quite a conservative estimate in my opinion, one in five children in the UK have a parent who's drinking at hazardous levels, and they're just dealing with it. And they're, half of them aren't talking to anybody. They're not asking for any help. They're doing all the things that I did when I was a kid. Mm. They're sitting their GCSEs. They're maybe not going to university because they don't think they can leave home. They're taking on huge caring responsibilities. And, you know, there's a whole scale that a lot of them are witnessing. They're six times more likely to witness domestic violence. They're three times more likely to suffer from poor mental health than, you know, suicidal ideology, for example, because of what's happening.
Mm.
And nobody is talking about the fact that actually it's happening to loads of kids and loads of young people.
Incredible numbers.
Yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it? What I think as well, when you're surviving and living in an environment like that, you're so busy trying to cope with a situation that you wouldn't necessarily saw something out. So doing the school talks is incredible.
And I don't think I would have necessarily reached out and asked for help when I was a kid for lots of different reasons. The only time I ever did try to do it was, I mean, you're going to have to do some sort of like notes on this as a cultural reference. Such a long time ago. I got the landline and the yellow pages, and I phoned Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was probably about 13, 14, and it was in the school holidays. And I can't remember what had happened to trigger this, but I'd really started to realise that something really bad was happening. And I phoned AA, and a guy answered the phone. And I said, oh, I'm just phoning to explain to you why my dad isn't an alcoholic. And he said, oh, okay.
Did he listen to you?
Yeah, he was amazing. And I said, well, you know, he drinks and he's, you know, I am worried, and he's definitely, you know, sometimes he hurts himself because of his drinking. But he's okay because we've still got a house and he has got a job, and he, I can remember saying this, which again is quite a judgy thing to say, but this was sort of my understanding. And I said, but you know, he isn't an alcoholic because he isn't getting up in the morning and he's not putting vodka on cornflakes. Which is such a stereotypical idea of what an alcoholic is. You know, so I'm just phoning to tell you that he isn't.
Oh, man, what a call.
Well, I mean, like, what a cry for help, right?
Yeah.
And he just said, you know, I'm really sorry to hear about that, but it sounds like you might be worried. And actually, I'm going to share a little bit about my story. And essentially what he said is, you don't have to be putting vodka on your cornflakes to be an alcoholic.
Mm.
And there are lots of different ways. And, you know, he said, I fell off a wall and broke my back and I still carried on drinking. I can remember it so vividly.
Wow.
You know, bad things happen when you're drinking, but sometimes they're not enough to make you stop. And he didn't signpost me to anything else. And probably, again, he didn't know about Nicore or Al-Anon or Alateen or any of those things. But actually, how much of a difference would it have made if the conversation had gone differently, if he had signposted me to them, if I had read a leaflet articulating the feelings I was having? It would have made a huge difference.
Yeah.
I remember once, probably early 20s, I went to an Al-Anon meeting local to where I lived at the time. And I walked in and it just wasn't the right time or the right place or the right people for me. And I sat there through this meeting and I sobbed throughout the whole thing. And I sobbed because I was so sad. And I couldn't, you know, at the end they say, would you like, I think, I can't remember, you know, would you like to share your story? Or do you? And I couldn't. And then I never went back, because actually that particular meeting to me at the time in my early 20s was just a load of middle-aged women moaning about their husbands.
Mm.
That was the sense. But I now think, what would have happened if they'd have said, maybe this wasn't, you know, if you didn't feel like this was the right place for you, have you heard of this charity?
Mm.
Have you seen this website? This is a phone number that you might want to think about ringing. Because essentially what I needed to hear was that I wasn't the only person going through it, that it, I could try and help my dad as much as I wanted, but actually it wasn't my fault and I couldn't control what he was going to do, but that actually I had options. So at Nicore, we call it the six C's, which is, I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. I can communicate my feelings, I can take care of myself, and I can make healthy choices.
Mm.
And actually, that's what I needed to hear.
It's very nourishing.
Yeah. I needed to hear that it wasn't my fault that my dad was continuing to drink and I wasn't going to be able to stop it, but that I could actually look after myself. And that me looking after myself was not wrapped up with making him better.
Yeah.
I think that's what I used to think. If I can make him better, or look after him, I'll feel better.
Mm. Which is common sense.
Obviously, yeah, totally. Yeah. But actually, what I needed to do was be told that it was not being disloyal to say that I was finding that really difficult. I was not being disloyal if I'd have sat there on a helpline or to somebody who understood and gone, I just wish he'd get it over and done with and die. Because that is how I felt.
Yeah.
Or, I feel really sad today because I feel really helpless and I can't control this. Or I'm really angry because I feel like I should have been able to go to university and enjoy that and I didn't. Or it's really unfair that I feel anxious all the time.
Do you tell kids the same thing, what you're saying, it's okay to get better? Because I'm sure there would be, if you're trying to get better, you almost feel like you're leaving them on their own. Does that make sense, to sink?
Yeah, it's about empowering the people who are affected. You know, it's sort of about that radius, isn't it? It's that ripple effect.
Yeah.
You've got the person in the middle of drinking, and then you've probably got the sort of first circle, which will be, you know, children, spouses, other loved ones. And actually, you might not be able to help that person in the middle, but you can talk to people who understand. You're not the only person going through it.
Yeah.
Any feeling you have is really valid, and you're not being disloyal if you speak to somebody and explain how you're feeling.
Yeah.
It's not disloyal, and it's, you're not a bad person if at 16 you go, I don't want to do this anymore, I deserve to go to university.
That's the key, because there's a lot of guilt and shame around
stuff. So much guilt and shame.
Because you can feel like in a family unit, you can feel like if you're not helping someone and you're helping yourself, that you're being almost greedy or selfish to take care of yourself, which is the opposite of, it's what you need to do, isn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, I also understand it. If you're going to be leaving another parent or siblings or, you know, other people at home, I can completely understand why you wouldn't. But again, it's about having those honest conversations and saying, it's really complicated, but none of it's your fault. And what works best for you? What do you want? And I think, again, when it's a parent you're looking after, you know, there's always, you know, blood's thicker than water and, oh, but they're your parent. And you, there's an awful lot of guilt kind of wrapped up in it as well. You know, they gave you life, they've provided for you, it's your turn to look after them. And actually, you wouldn't stay in a friendship potentially that treated you like that, or a relationship. Yeah. And again, there's a complexity when it's a family member. And, you know, kids don't have a choice a lot of the time. That's the other thing, is actually your situation is your situation.
Yeah.
And it's not going to demonstrably improve, because where are you actually going to go at the moment? You know, unless your situation is sufficiently bad to trigger a social services intervention or something.
Mm.
You know, millions of children live in less than ideal circumstances, but nothing's going to change. So actually all you can do is teach them resilience, coping mechanisms, give them a place to go to feel heard. Lots of children still want to protect their parents. They don't want any, they don't want those interventions. They don't want everybody knowing. That's why the helpline's anonymous. They don't necessarily want that judgment, and they still feel that stigma. But it's really important that they know that they can access help in a lot of different ways if they want to.
What's the kind of questions that are asked? If a child's phoning in, is there a kind of majority of questions like, what do I need to do, or I don't feel safe, or I need something? Like, what kind of questions were they asked?
A huge range. So it can be children of any age. So you can have, you know, I think the youngest caller they've ever had was maybe four.
Wow.
But it also can be people in their 40s, perhaps dealing with a parent who is now really unwell. It can be people in their 50s, 60s, 70s who are sort of coming to terms with their childhood experience. Essentially, it's there for anybody who's been affected by a parent's drinking, but it can also be people who are concerned about somebody else. So it can be teachers, it can be other professionals, for example. It's also not always somebody in crisis. Actually, some children phone the helpline repeatedly for, you know, months or years, just to talk about how their day was, because they may not have that outlet at home.
Mm.
Not everybody who phones is in an acute situation. And of course, that does happen. You know, you'll get phone calls saying, he's going to have a drink and I need to stop him. How do I do that? And of course, the answer is, you can't. You know, that's not your job.
Mm.
But it can also be, I did really well in a maths test today.
Oh.
But interestingly, and as a result, hopefully, of the school program, they've seen a real rise in phone calls from kind of 15 to 17-year-olds in the last few months, which I think is hopefully a direct result of the work that we're doing in schools. But, you know, a big focus at the moment in terms of the school project, we're trying to go to universities, because just because you've left home, just because you've closed the door on your house and you've moved away, which everyone thinks, oh, brilliant, actually, that can be really tough. So we're going to freshers' fairs and we're saying, you know, just because you're not physically there anymore doesn't mean this still isn't difficult for you.
Yeah.
And actually, in terms of schools, there's whole groups of children who historically haven't accessed it. So we're working on, we've got presentations in sign language, we've got leaflets now printed in Braille, we're working on social stories for neurodivergent children. You know, if you're suffering, if you're neurodivergent and perhaps emotions are difficult for you anyway, if you're feeling all of those complex feelings because your parent's drinking and you've got no idea what to do with those, you know, the teachers are going to see that in terms of behavior and all of those things as well.
Yeah.
And actually, how can we reach the people who need to hear the message the most? So that's the real focus, is as many as we can in any way.
I hear you. What's your reaction from the teachers? Because when we go and do talks, sometimes a teacher comes over and is like, I think I've got a problem too. Like, how do I deal with it?
Yeah, that's exactly like a completely unpredicted result of this,
yeah.
Which, you know, going to school. So I think that there's two things. One, they are really surprised when you say one in five children in your school. So 20% of every tutor group, every year group, is statistically affected by this. So there's sort of several things to that. And you kind of go, if 20% of your pupils were coming in and saying, my parent has been diagnosed with another terminal illness. You know, I always use cancer, which seems unfair. But, you know, if you've got 20% of your students have a parent with cancer to the point where they're having to take on caring responsibilities or it's affecting their mental health, what would you put in place for them? And the answer is a lot.
Yeah.
There would be no shame in that student coming in and saying what was happening at home. There would be no shame in that student coming in and, you know, maybe struggling in lessons or being offered extra support. That would be a given. But it's not happening for children affected by addiction because they're not saying what's happening because they're worried about consequences and they are so kind of bogged down by the stigma and the judgment. But essentially, their roles and responsibilities are the same, right? They're caring, yeah. They're anxious, they're worried about their parents' well-being. So the one in five thing is always a massive surprise.
Yeah.
And, you know, thinking about exams, if you had a child with a poorly parent who was doing GCSEs or A-levels, would you be putting in accommodations for them? What would you do around study leave? Let's get that in place when we're changing out the word cancer for addiction.
What's the reaction to that? Because I think it is generally a surprise for people.
A massive surprise. And then the thing I'd never really accounted for in terms of outcome or time for these presentations is exactly what you've said. You go and you train 100 teachers on an inset day, right, in a big secondary school. And then at the end, you've got 20 of them. You've got 20% of them waiting to speak to you. And they're either saying, I've just, you know, that's how I grew up. What can I do? Or exactly as you've said, my children are potentially in that. What can I do? But what's brilliant about that is that actually when they then know about us and they know about the conversations you can have and you've got a school that's willing to engage with it, those teachers then become really passionate about becoming that lead for the topic in school. So, you know, they then, we do our NACOA training with them. They then have a badge that they put on their lanyard. We then speak to every pupil in that school. We kind of do, you know, whole year group assemblies. And then you can see the pupils connecting the dots. The posters are up in school. The leaflets are in pastoral care. They've got teachers wearing a NACOA PIN badge who they know they can trust.
That's amazing.
Know they can ask to phone the helpline during school hours, for example. And that's how you break that down. And hopefully they start to get the help that they need.
Such great work, Amy. Thank you so much for today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholford and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up. And you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholford. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.